Species unite.
When those fires happen about 8 o'clock in the morning, it goes completely black. So the sky is completely black. There's no light. The sound is like being under a train. It's unbelievably loud. And of course, the heat, you know, you are right in the heat of the fire and the smell and the taste. So every one of his senses was taken from one world, a world where it was light, where he could move around, to another world without the meta narrative that human beings have, that we're in an age of climate catastrophe.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Danielle Sellermeyer. Danielle is a professor at the University of Sydney, and she's deputy director of the Sydney Environment Institute and lead of the Multi-Species Justice Project. She has been a longtime human activist, but in the last decade has expanded to all species. She lives on a multi-species community in rural Australia. She lived through the Black Summer Fires in Australia in 2019 and 2020, and she wrote a book about it called Summertime, Reflections on a Vanishing Future. I asked her to begin our conversation by reading an excerpt from it.
I went and sat alone, just down the slope from where Jimmy has been lying. It's way down in the bush over a gully. The light is soft. You can hear the birds and the wind moving through the trees. The air and the earth are cool, and the smell is of leaves and the river. I cannot presume to know what he is doing when he lies there, but it seems to me that he is taking himself back to an ecology not wrought by the terror of the fires, nor fueled by our violence on the earth. He is letting another earth heal him.
So beautiful. It is so good to have you here. Thank you so much for doing this, Danny.
My pleasure.
I'm really excited to have you here. The book is so profound. It is so many lessons about what's happening right now on this planet, about how we treat other species, about how we treat the planet. And so we're going to start here. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Why don't we start with your property where you live and the Interspecies Justice Collective? That's what you call it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So given that you've asked me to start there, I'm going to start with a land acknowledgement, which is the land where the community is and where I live, work and play, which is the unceded lands of the Dharawal people of the Yuin Nation. And I want to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging and thank the people of that land for all of their care for the multi-species relations that mean that we now are able to live the way we do. I had been a human rights activist and a human rights scholar, and several years ago, it occurred to me that there was something really constrained about the frame that I was working in, which placed justice at the edge of human beings. So claimed to be universal, but actually was universal with respect to humans only and all earth others, so all other animals, forests, rivers, mountains, the ecological systems within which we live and thrive and flourish were on the outside, so they weren't considered subjects of justice. And for reasons that maybe we'll get into in another conversation, that just no longer made sense to me and seemed like an injustice. And as I moved into this in terms of my work and my ideas, I also realized that if I took seriously that as a human being, I'm always made by the relations in which I'm embedded, that really meant that I needed to live differently as well, that I couldn't think differently, I couldn't teach differently, I couldn't write differently if I didn't live differently. And that meant living amongst Earth others, like sharing my life with them in a very day-to-day way. And so at the end of 2015, we moved to a really extraordinary high valley rainforest in the southeast of Australia and started to experiment in what it meant to live with all Earth others. So gradually, a number of who I think of as refugee animals, so domesticated animals who had come from different types of bad situations, industrial animal agriculture, but other forms of captivity, came to live with us. And then all of the animals who already lived there, the wombats and the wallabies and the snakes, and then also the soil and the river and the rainforest trees and everyone else who grew there. And over the last few years, the humans who live there, have been trying to learn what it means to live together in a way where everybody's interests count. In our culture, we are so accustomed to the idea that human interests organize life and everybody else has to get into line to produce the type of goods that we think are good for us. And what does it mean to put that aside and take seriously that everybody who is there has interests? So the pigs have interests and the donkeys have interests and the soil has interests and the trees have interests. And sometimes they come into conflict with each other. Like, you know, donkeys are hard hoofed animals and that's bad for soils in Australia. So how do we live in a way that everybody can flourish as much as possible in relationship with everybody else?
You had about 4 years before the fires of living this way. And you say in your book, as soon as you got there the very first time, you knew that this was where you wanted to die. You were home. Mm-hmm. During those 4 years, you had a lot of time to actually be there, and this became your home. Mm. And then the fires come. And you're in a rainforest, so you're not expecting any tragic catastrophes to happen. So will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I live in Australia, and Australia is a fire-prone country. In fact, it's a fire-adapted ecology. There are certain plants in Australia that can only thrive through the seeds being opened up by fire. But two qualities of those fires. Firstly, they have historically been at a certain level in terms of their intensity and their spread. But also there are certain parts of Australia that are definitely not fire adapted. So rainforests are not fire adapted, and the remnant rainforests on the east coast of Australia, most of them have never burned. And so in my mind, and I think that this is a signal of the degree to which I'm talking about us in a particular culture, somehow always consider ourselves exceptional. You know, this is one of the qualities of the climate catastrophe is a lot of us tell ourselves, well, it's going to happen to someone else, somewhere else, sometime else. And my particular version of that was, well, we live in the rainforest, and so we're immunized from the catastrophic threats of fire. And there was objective scientific evidence to back that, but then that got interpolated into the type of story that I told myself about being safe. And so when the fire started to burn in the north, I paid attention, but then the Dorrigo rainforests in northern New South Wales burnt several months before the fire came to us. And I have a very exact memory of where I was standing. I was listening to the radio. I was on the land. It was a burning hot day, and I heard that the Dorrigo rainforests were burning. And it was like a truck hit me. And I realized that this wasn't someone else, somewhere else, sometime else. This was actually going to happen to us.
Well, I think one thing, a lot of things about your book, but one was I read it recently and it takes place in 2019. And we've had so many climate catastrophes since then and before then. And the way they seem to go, because they're global and they're always happening. And even though the Australia wildfires were one of the worst we've seen in the past, you know, decade, two decades, right? And so people were very much there watching and paying attention and terrified for you and devastated. 3 billion animals were killed. It was unbelievable. But we went right into COVID after the fires and then into so many other catastrophes. And that's kind of how, in one way, the world has been acting like climate change isn't here yet. You know, that we're, it's like the catastrophes aren't here, even though they're massive. And in another ways, they come and go so fast. Like there's another one every few months. Your book really slowed it down for me in the sense of it really brought me through your experience in the fires and brought me through, you know, this is what climate change really is in a very present being there kind of way. And what it also did for me, as much as I felt massive empathy, pain, everything for all the animals that get hurt and all these fires and all the people, of course, I've never thought about climate change from the animal's perspective. And that is something you do like so beautifully. And of course, they have a perspective on this. Will you talk about that?
I had many aspirations with the book. There was so much to write about, to try and get across from living through those particular fires. But I think what was most important for me to try and convey was precisely what you said, Elizabeth, that human beings aren't the only ones who are having an experience of the climate catastrophe. And not only are we not the only ones who are having an experience of it, but we're not the only ones who are making meaning of it. And we're not the only ones who are having a complex range of emotions around it. So as you said, during the Black Summer fires, there was an extraordinary amount of media attention, in particular to the animals who were being immolated. And on the one hand, I saw that as a real opening. People were paying attention to other animals at the same time. I think that was an effect of the scale of disaster. But also there were many charismatic animals that have this iconic status for a lot of people around the world. So koalas and kangaroos, to see the images of them being burnt or trying to escape the fires, had this very direct impact on people. And yet what was missing from that narrative was their experience. So we as human beings were having an experience of them as the objects of our attention, but they were having a first-person experience themselves. And because I was living so intimately with other animals as they were going through that, I witnessed that very directly. So I witnessed their sensing the fires as they were approaching where we live together. And then, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about Jimmy, then I shared the period of grief with a particular other animal, a pig, Jimmy, whose sister was immolated, was burnt to death, and he lived through that apocalypse. So he was evacuated. Jimmy and Katie were evacuated. We evacuated them about 3.5 hours away from where we lived to where we thought was safe. And then 3 days later, that place became one of the worst epicenters of the fire. And Katie was killed. And at first we thought that Jimmy was also killed, but then he turned up 36 hours later and he was alive. When the roads opened again a week later, we went down and brought him home. And that period when he came home, when he was in trauma and in very deep grief, he had spent every day of his life with his sister. I was there going through it with him. And perhaps most importantly, he made it very clear to me that this was his experience, not my experience. So all that I wanted to do, I think, you know, when we are overwhelmed by the scale of a catastrophe, we'll often channel those emotions into something that we think we have control of. And so saving Jimmy, making sure that Jimmy didn't die as Katie had died, became the point of my focus. And all I wanted to do was make sure that he stayed alive, because he stopped eating and he stopped drinking and it was tremendously hot. And so I would spend a lot of my days trying to get him to eat, trying to get him to drink, putting cold towels over him. And he made it very clear that this was his journey of grief. He was going to start eating or not. He was going to start drinking or not. He would allow me to be with him for a period of time, and then he would go and move himself somewhere else and do whatever it was that he was doing to work out how he was going to move through this period of unimaginable grief and loss and trauma. Some of the listeners may have lived through this scale of fire, but it is very difficult to imagine. So the fire that he lived through, when those fires happen, was about 8 o'clock in the morning. It goes completely black. So the sky is completely black. There's no light. The sound is like being under a train. It's unbelievably loud. And of course the heat, you know, you are right in the heat of the fire, and the smell and the taste. So every one of his senses was taken from one world, a world where it was light, where he could move around, to another world without the meta narrative that human beings have, that we're in an age of climate catastrophe. He moved from one world to another world, came out of the catastrophic world, or the intense acute catastrophic world. His sister was dead, and then he has to work out, what does it mean to live in this world again? And because he was so clear and because his emotions were so complex, he simultaneously conveyed to me that other animals are going through these complex emotions, but also this type of resistance that, actually, no human being, you don't get to save me. You don't get to decide what I'm going to do with this. I will work out what I'm going to do with this. And that, we have so often removed animals of their capacities to resist through domestication, through all the forms of violence that we wreak on them, that resistance is actually a really important part of coming into a respectful relationship and understanding that they are moving through the world in their own way. So everything that I learnt through the fires about how it is for other animals and what I wanted to convey in the book, I definitely owe to them.
Well, before the fires, it feels like on your where you live, you had already set the stage for them being allowed to resist. And it's kind of a no rules in comparison to most places, right? They had a lot of free will, the yeah. animals that live on your property. And so that relationship had already begun, I feel like, before the fires. And so when he told you or conveyed to you after the fires, hey, this is my grief, not yours. If I die, it's on me kind yeah. of thing. The two of you already had this kind of relationship that you knew to back off, even though you wanted to get close. And how long did he stay in that state of not eating, not drinking?
About 10 days.
Close to death.
Yeah, yeah, in absolutely extraordinary heat. I mean, he was drinking a little bit. He was obviously drinking enough to be able to survive, but he was not eating and he was really not moving around.
So for him to come home without her, right after being that traumatized, he didn't eat for 10 days, right? He didn't function.
It was a different life. He was coming into a different life. And it was interesting because, so when we went to collect him, we got to the land where he had survived, and it was like being in a nuclear zone. You know, the land was black. There was nothing there. All of the fences had been burnt down. The houses had been burnt down. And so we went to look for Jimmy, and we're walking, and it's a week after the fire has passed through, but the land was still hot under my boots. so we went out to look for him, and we were calling him and calling him, and eventually he came. It took about 20 minutes. He heard us calling him, but he didn't come right up to us. You know, he obviously knew that it was us, but he didn't walk right next to us. He walked parallel to us, about maybe 20 feet away. But like I said, he adored Leonard, and so Leonard managed to get him onto the float by giving him Arnott's biscuits, this particular type of biscuits that he really liked. But on the way home, we were actually very afraid that he was going to die in the float because it was so hot and his temperature was extremely high. So we kept on pouring water on him to try and keep his body temperature down. But it was took us about, I think, 5 hours to get home, and it was a very touch-and-go journey. We actually got a vet to meet us halfway just to see if there was something that we needed to give him. And when we first got home, it was almost like he stepped out of the trauma. He was so relieved to be home. And the first thing that he did, you know, we made up his mud bath, and the first thing he did was put his body into the water and cover himself with water and mud and cool. And we thought, oh, he's okay, right? You know, he's back. He's now going to be safe. And that night he went and slept in their house, what had been their house. And it was really the next morning that he moved into this very clear period of trauma. And my sense is that, you know, like us, we can have this illusion that things are all right. He had the reconnection with place, but then he realized that it was not the same place anymore because Katie wasn't there anymore. And this is all my surmising. I think her smell must have still been very present there. And so she was there, but she was not there. And so he came back into reality in a way of what the future was going to be like without her.
Oh, so depressing. It's so heartbreaking to picture him like having that awakening. But it is a lot of what we do as humans, right? We go when in trauma, you kind of come in, you go out.
Exactly.
You're shocked. You're acting like everything's normal. And then you're catatonic.
The other thing I wanted to say is that when he came home, everyone else was still evacuated. So we also wondered, did he think everyone else was dead? Like no one else was there, because he lived also with the donkeys and the horses and the ducks and the chickens and everybody else, and no one was there apart from the wild animals and the humans. And so I'm guessing he was like, is it not just Katie that's dead? Is everybody else dead? He was also dealing with, why can't I see anyone else? Why can't I hear anyone else?
And when he decided, I don't know if decided is the right word, okay, I'm through the heaviest part of this grief and kind of come back. How was that?
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. So, you know, we were like the kind of classic Jewish parents, you know, we'd try and feed him this, we'd try and feed him that. And one night we ate soba noodles. And so we bought him this type of soba noodle. I think it was soba noodles and carrots and had some tofu in it. And we bought it down. I remember it was in a white bowl. And I mean, I've spoken about in the first person, but all of this I was going through with my partner, and my partner, who I call Elle in the book, he and Jimmy were just extraordinarily close. And I remember Leonard gave Jimmy this bowl of soba noodles and he started slurping it up, and the absolute joy that we felt, because he wasn't just eating, right? He was signaling a choice to move back into life. I mean, this is one of the great lessons that I have learned from other animals. His capacity then to re-embrace life was so inspiring. I don't know if you or anyone else has ever lived with chickens who have come out of industrial factory farms, you know, which are basically torture chambers. And when they first come out and they put their feet on the earth for the first time and they see the sky for the first time and they drink, you know, rather than just having one drop of water that they're allowed to get, and they can move more than a foot or less than a foot, and they tentatively move into life. And then a few weeks later, those who are able to survive, they are in their life. You know, they are a girl gang and they are out there and they're getting around and they're scratching and they're moving. And this capacity that, I'm not saying that they don't carry trauma. Many animals carry trauma into their future. But their capacity to re-embrace life and to experience the joy of life at the same time as holding whatever trauma they've experienced, it is pretty damn inspiring. And Jimmy, you know, Jimmy was an exemplar of that.
Yeah. So once he was back, he was back.
He was back. He was back. Yeah.
What about the donkeys and their experience of the fires?
It was very interesting. The day that we were evacuating them, they went down to a pasture right down the bottom of the property where they almost never go. And I could not get them to come up. They definitely knew that something was up. They're very good mind readers. And I finally got them up and put them into the horses' stables, shut them in, and we got a truck to load them to take them somewhere that we thought was going to be safe for them. And because we had made a very conscious decision not to train any of the animals, so I don't train them, I don't put halters on them, I don't teach them to lead, I had no way of getting them onto the truck. And they were not going to go. They were terrified. It was extremely hot. Everyone was in a panic. The fires were not very far away.
Could you hear the fires?
We couldn't hear them because, you know, when I say not far away, so fires move incredibly fast. So they can move over, you know, 40 odd miles, probably in about 20 minutes. So they can be reasonably far away physically, but they come very quickly. So, but we could definitely smell them and you could see the light. And they did not want to go. And I was so determined. So at a certain point, Leonard said to me, you know, we may not be able to get them on the truck because they were so resistant to going. And I remember saying, we're going to get them on the truck if I have to break their legs to get them on the truck. I'm not leaving them here. Anyway, eventually we got them on and they were evacuated to a place that was reasonably close to a town, which didn't mean it was safe because towns did burn down, but it was a place where there was a lot of open land. There wasn't a lot of bushland that would burn, and there were also enough humans for the fire services to be interested in really trying to protect that area. So where we live, there are very few humans. It's extremely remote and there is a lot of bushland. So the fire service had said to us, we're not coming to you. No way. We're at the end of a dead end road. So they were evacuated to the same place as the horses were. And those, I think they were away for about 3 weeks down there in a place that was very hot and very dry. And they definitely didn't like it. They, you know, I went there twice a day to feed them and to make sure that they were okay. And they were pretty pissed at me that they weren't at home. But when they came home after the fires, it was quite funny. I think they knew they were coming home. They got onto the truck pretty easily. They came home and their joy at returning home, as soon as they got off the truck, they kicked their heels in the air. They ran all over the property. I mean, everybody, when they came home, when the ducks came home, they went right into the water in the pond. Everybody was so happy to come home. But when they were, for all of them, being away was really being torn out of the fabric of their lives. But again, I think they readjusted pretty quickly in a way that is often more difficult for humans.
Well, and moving them for 3 weeks, as traumatic as that is, it's compared to what could have happened to them. It's
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one person who it was really tough for is so one of the horses who lives there and who lives with us. He was about 30 then, and he's blind. And so orientation is extremely important for him. He can move around the land. He can run up and down the fields, up and down the hills. He completely navigates the land because he has the map of the land in his body. But taking him somewhere else where he didn't know where he was and getting him up and down afloat when he's blind, that was very difficult for him. And he's still with us. He's now 34. Extraordinary. Amazing. And I do fear for him in a way more than others.
The book really, like, as much as of course I fell in love with Jimmy, and the entire story is beyond devastating. And the bigger picture of where we are right now and how we're living on this planet, but how we're living with other species as well. Your book just makes you think and not stop thinking about all of the above. There's a lot of problems. The Australia wildfires were one of the biggest, but there have been a ton, like I was saying earlier, of massive climate catastrophes in the past decade, two decades. And they're getting worse and worse. And yet we go through one big one and then we act like nothing's wrong. And that kind of seems to be how a lot of the world is handling this. And so from your perspective of someone who's literally lived in it and watched your world around you burn down, how do we change?
Well, that's the $64 trillion question.
Right.
Firstly, I think, as you intimated, it's really important to break down the we. So there are very many different we's.
Yes.
And there are many humans for whom climate catastrophe is a daily reality, whether it means that they don't have access to food, or they don't have access to water, or their lives have been permanently taken apart because of the impacts of either the slow violence of climate change, so drought, the type of violence that's emerged around long-term decimation of landscapes, or because, say, people in Pakistan who will not get their houses back because the levels of devastation were so great. So there are many human beings for whom it is a day-to-day reality. There are people, the global north, who have, through layers of privilege, managed to insulate themselves to some degree. It's only a matter of time before it's going to affect everybody more directly. But I think part of the problem is that we live within all sorts of structures that deny the reality of climate change. And when I say structures, I don't just mean buildings and cities and laws and politics, but also the stories that we tell ourselves. So we, and again, I'm talking about a particular we, but we live within the story of human triumphalism, of techno-modernism, of infinite progress, that yes, these bad things happen, but we're going to be able to overcome it through human ingenuity combined with technology. So I think techno-modernism, that capitalist narrative about there is what, it's going to be geoengineering of some sort, solar, wind power, is going to overcome this. And so we're very interpolated into that story about ourselves. We're very convinced that yes, these bad things are happening, but we see them as exceptions to the trajectory of human life, as opposed to actually we're not on that trajectory anymore. And there's a lot of data telling us that we're not on that trajectory anymore. So we know that we're no longer, and I'm talking about in the West, the next generations are not living longer. They are not wealthier. So even within our own data collections, we are starting to get information to tell us that we're off that trajectory, but we remain constituted by that story about ourselves. And at the same time, you know, there are huge interests at work from fossil fuel companies and from all of the economic and political interests in retaining that form of life that are heavily invested and doing a lot of work in ensuring that that remains the story to be told. This is not, it's not just it happens to be this way. This is a right. field which is saturated with very strong interests and power that not only for many years actively denied the reality of climate change, but now are pumping the stories of techno-modernism. You know, let's look at who is actually pushing the narrative that there is a technological solution. It's mainly a particular part of politics and fossil fuel companies. And at the same time, everything else that is happening, all the emergence of hyper-nationalism, racism, ethno-nationalism, which is highly linked to the climate crisis, but also something of a distraction. You know, the problem yeah. is that we've got people coming over the border, as opposed to the problem is that climate catastrophe is happening in parts of South America, which is driving conflict, and that's why people are coming over the border. So these narratives are constructed with particular interests at work that then make it very difficult for people who don't spend their lives like I do thinking about this stuff to actually penetrate what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. But still, how does this narrative change?
Yeah, for me, the diagnosis is we need to understand the etiology of the problem in order to be able to work out what to do with it, what to do about it. There are many answers to that question. One of the answers, and the answer that I was trying to respond to or to be part of that answer in summertime, is to tell what I call human-sized stories. So one of the difficulties in having an embodied comprehension of climate change, so we can have an intellectual comprehension of it, but we don't really get it in our bodies. One of the reasons that it's so difficult is the scale, right? The scale of what's going on. And so being able to tell stories that we can actually feel in our bodies and then tell those stories in a way that also links it to the larger scale of what's happening, I think that's part of the work. And then a huge part of the work is going to be resistance and social movements, and social movements supporting people in the global south yeah. to actually amplify the stories that they're telling, not to marginalize those stories as if they don't matter to us, but become allies of those stories. And of course, I'm not just talking about people in Pakistan or Bangladesh or Libya. I'm also talking about people who live in countries like the United States or Australia, First Nations people, peoples of color who are already living with it. So amplifying their experiences, becoming allies of those experiences. And just sheer resistance, you know, that it remains extraordinary to me that given the gravity of the violence that is going on, the political violence and the climate violence, that there is not more active resistance, you know, active resistance to fossil fuel projects, civil disobedience. I think that in the coming time, we are going to have to see much more widespread civil disobedience. That's my view.
I absolutely agree. And I agree with the fact that it's absurd that there isn't more already, because we need it.
Yeah.
And we need more books like yours and more people like you telling these stories, because it is the stories, like you said, the human-sized stories, that's where all the power is in terms of really understanding what's happening to the world right now. And your story in summertime, Jimmy's story, it's big stuff. It's profound. It changed me. Thank you, Danny, very much for today. Thank you for putting this book in the world and for all that you do.
Wow, thank you so much.
To learn more about Danny, to read Summertime, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and can do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Sam Kosel, and Anna Kohlner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.